So I'm going to take this afternoon's discussion in a very different direction. There will be hopefully a couple of connections with the things that have preceded, but I hope you will permit me to take things in a slightly more applied, more current world direction. What I wanted to do was to explore a couple of issues that that relate to my own work. So I work both in the Oxford Uehiro Centre, but I'm also a practicing neonatal intensive care doctor. And the first case is a case that I was involved with of a fetus who had been diagnosed antenatally with severe hydrocephalus. That means that the fluid spaces in the centre of the brain were extremely swollen. This image is of a brain with these black bits in the middle being the fluid spaces that are normally tiny and were swollen, compressing the brain around. The baby had a number of other abnormalities as well. And there were questions about then the management of this baby after birth, whether or not it was reasonable for us to take a palliative approach, not offering or not providing surgery, but providing comfort care in the anticipation that the baby would subsequently die. There are a range of other related questions that might be applied, including whether or not this falls into the category in which termination of pregnancy might be permitted. In different countries, there are different limits that are applied. There are sometimes questions about timing of delivery, because with these babies, as they get bigger towards term, the head becomes so large that it's difficult for the baby to deliver either vaginally or by a cesarean section. Indeed, some of them, the fluid needs to be aspirated, the head shrunk acutely immediately prior to delivery, which usually results in the death of the baby. The second type of case was one that a neurosurgeon that I was speaking to, in fact I gave this talk to neurosurgeons a couple of months ago, shared with me. This is an ex-premature infant. I look after premature infants a lot of the time, who had a severe hypoxic brain injury, lack of oxygen, who had a bleeding in this fluid space in the middle of the brain, subsequently had a buildup of fluid. And at the point that the neurosurgeons were involved, the baby was neurologically extremely compromised, was fed by an artificial tube, didn't have any purposeful movements, was on a mechanical ventilator. There were a range of things to suggest that this baby was extremely compromised from a neurological point of view. And there was a question about, at that point, providing neurosurgery, which was being requested by the family. After seeking religious advice, that was what they felt was best for their child. So in this question, it's the opposite dilemma, whether or not treatment should may be refused on the basis of the baby's prognosis. So there are these two types of questions, and we'll see how we go with time. I'm going to try and focus in particular on this question of declining to provide invasive treatment or surgical treatment for infants with severe hydrocephalus, and trying to unpick some of the issues that might relate to that, and then we'll see some of the links with the talk before. But just to run through some of the challenges in the first type of scenario. So one of the challenges for thinking about cases like this is to know what exactly the prognosis is. This is an example of some of the data that's available. This is a fairly recent case series from Cambridge. There were 23 cases of severe ventricular megaly, that means big ventricles. 10 of them had termination of pregnancy, and these were the range of outcomes in these fetuses. There were 10 who were live born. I seem to have lost three of the cases. I can't remember what happened to them. Two died early, one was ultimately said to be normal, one had hemiparesis, and six had abnormal development of a range of severity, from one with seizures and visual impairment, another with cerebral palsy, a couple with severe learning disabilities. So a fair spectrum of outcomes. But one of the challenges is that half of these babies had termination of pregnancy, and it's not clear whether those who continued and those who terminated the pregnancy are exactly equivalent. So in this sort of situation, data from Ireland is actually quite useful, where termination of pregnancy is not available. So in their study, which was not much larger, there was a series of similar proportion, about a quarter of those babies were stillborn. They had only one case of termination of pregnancy. And amongst the survivors, 50% of them were severely disabled. Four were mildly handicapped and one was normal. So interestingly, quite different rates of non-severe disability amongst survivors. So the first kind of clinical challenge is to work out what the prognosis is for a group of infants with a severe neurological disorder. Partly this is difficult because there's a lot of heterogeneity between different types of causes of buildup of fluid, very small numbers of reported cases, and large numbers of terminations of pregnancy, meaning that the available data is based on a small and unrepresentative subset. The second sort of more normative challenge is, if you have some figures like the ones that I've raised, these figures of rates of disability, the question is that high enough for palliative care, non-treatment, to be a reasonable option enough? Clearly, at some point, the chance of disability becomes sufficiently low that doctors wouldn't normally think that it's a reasonable option to be offering palliative management. But where is that threshold? And that's a topic that I've talked about at great length in other fora, and I won't go over that in great deal of detail now. There are two related questions: what chance of disability is high enough, what severity of disability is bad enough, and the approach that I've talk about in my book, which I can point people towards if they're interested in, is the focus on the question of whether there's uncertainty about whether treatment would be in the child's best interests. One practical question that might be helpful for clinicians is whether the prognosis for this group of infants is similar enough to another group of infants where palliative care is an accepted pathway. If it's similar, then it seems that we ought to treat like cases alike. If it's dissimilar, then we need to find some reason, see if there's a justifiable reason for treating them differently. There's a third practical challenge, which is what happens if surgery is not provided. And some may have seen these sort of pictures which appear in the newspapers from time to time. This is an infant who's 18 months old who had untreated severe neonatal hydrocephalus. So one of the challenges is, if the surgeons don't provide treatment, if a palliative course is followed, the infants don't necessarily die. They may end up, like this poor infant, alive, but even more compromised. And it's interesting to go back in time to understand what the natural history is if you don't intervene with shunts for infants with hydrocephalus. This was a paper I found from the 1960s with a cohort of 47 infants from Chicago who had no surgical intervention because, on the basis of their features, the limited imaging at the time — they didn't have ultrasound in that period, but they had kind of clinical tools — they were thought to have poor prognosis because they had thin mantles, that means not very much brain, large heads, or generally unimposing appearance. Of this cohort, 21 died at an average age of 3 years. But 24 of them survived, and these were the range of outcomes in this cohort of infants with severe hydrocephalus. 9 were judged to have near normal social acceptability, 6 were ambulant but had severe intellectual disability, and 9 were poor with severe physical and cognitive impairment. And interestingly, the kind of spectrum of outcomes is not so different from the Irish data that I pointed to a few minutes ago. It points to a phenomenon that I describe as palliative harm. And these are conditions where the prognosis for infants is sufficiently poor that treatment limitation is often thought to be ethically appropriate, but these infants have a low dependence on life-sustaining treatment. And provision of palliative care may not lead to death, but rather to survival in a worse state. I'm going to move on to the second type of case, just in view of time, and we can come back to talk about that first case if people are interested. So this particular case of an infant who appears to be severely neurologically compromised, there's a question about whether or not to provide surgical treatment of the hydrocephalus or not. And the feeling from clinicians, and the neurosurgeon who I spoke to, was that we shouldn't be providing surgery for this infant. Well, so on what basis might clinicians make that sort of judgment, that it's inappropriate, unethical, to provide surgery even if parents request it? Well, often the sort of language that gets expanded around is that treatment would be futile. Julian and I have written about a short review for a clinical journal about the concept of futility and the different types of definitions that you'll find in the literature. So people sometimes refer to physiological futility, quantitative or qualitative futility, futility in the context of imminent demise or of a condition that will lead to demise within a longer period of time. But in essence, there are only two kind of ethical justifications for doctors refusing to provide treatment on the grounds that they judge it to be medically inappropriate or futile. Either the treatment would harm the patient or the treatment would harm other patients, largely by the consuming of limited resources. So would either of these conditions apply to this situation of an infant with severe hydrocephalus and apparent very poor neurological function? Would treatment be harmful? Is continued life a harm for this child? Well, there are two challenges more broadly. In this particular case, I think that's a possibility. So one of the challenges is what I refer to as the tolerability paradox. So when we're thinking about children with severe disability and thinking about the suffering in their existence, there is a sense in which their lives may be better off the more severely cognitively impaired they are. So we usually think, clinicians usually think, that more severe degrees of impairment would be more likely to lead to a decision to limit treatment or not provide treatment. But in terms of the child's subjective state, there is a sense in which those who are more severely impaired may be unaware of their limitations, not distressed by the fact that they're unable to do things that their peers are able to do, whereas those who are more mildly or moderately affected may be more distressed by their state. The second challenge is so that's the tolerability paradox. The second challenge is the disability paradox, which is a paradox that comes from social science literature, that the subjective quality of life of individuals with disabilities that are judged from the outside to be extremely aversive and unpleasant are often significantly better than people would expect. So the reports from those who are disabled who say, look, my life's okay, you think that you wouldn't want to live in a state such as this, however, I don't think it's so bad. And there is a little bit of literature on the quality of life, subjective quality of life of children with hydrocephalus. These are the utility scores. They're going to be far too small to read from the back of the audience, but what you can see is there's a reasonable spectrum of health utility scores from these from this study, from some significant proportion who are clustered up near one, so near normal health. The average score was somewhere around the middle, and there are a very small number whose utility scores were actually less than zero. Those were I think based on caregiver reports, because those individuals weren't able to score their own lives, but suggesting that for these individuals, based on their caregivers, that perhaps their life was a harm. But obviously overall, for infants with severe hydrocephalus, the majority, judged by themselves or by their caregivers, have lives that are subjectively worth living. And there's a third challenge, which is that if we're trying to think about the harm of providing surgery, shunt surgery itself is not terribly complicated, nor likely to be highly burdensome. Indeed, it may relieve discomfort or suffering for the child. So if we're trying to decide we're not going to provide shunt surgery for this child because we think it's harmful, there's a real problem, because it's not clear that these children are necessarily harmed by their continuing life. Indeed, in intensive care, we have analgesics that should be able to prevent them from suffering, from being on the ventilator. Their subjective experiences may well be better than we anticipate, and the shunt surgery itself is not terribly burdensome. Would treatment harm others? Well, here, as Julian and I have argued, is where the key argument lies in terms of futile treatment in intensive care. So I went looking to try and work out just what the resource implications are of providing shunt surgery for infants with severe hydrocephalus. These are some figures that came from Australia. There are different types of surgery that might be involved. The initial surgery itself, putting in a shunt, it's a kind of simple piece of plumbing, piece of plastic, goes into the fluid space, then is tunneled under the skin to drain, usually into the peritoneum. That's not terribly expensive. Sometimes the shunt gets blocked and needs to be revised. That's also not terribly expensive. But when the shunts get infected, it tends to be associated with significantly more cost, usually because of because of prolonged hospitalisation. In the US, the costs were higher. But that's partly because they've combined the different types of admissions, but also because the healthcare system in the US is significantly more expensive. Is this too expensive? How do we evaluate treatments? Well, interestingly, I did find a kind of cost-effectiveness analysis of shunt surgery for infant hydrocephalus in sub-Saharan Africa. And in that context, and this is not simply severe hydrocephalus, providing this type of surgery is enormously cost-effective, saves huge numbers of disability-adjusted life years for relatively little cost. But that's not really what we're talking about. We're talking about infants with severe hydrocephalus. This is my back-of-the-envelope calculation based on the sort of infection rates and failure rates that I could find, suggesting an overall cost of about £16,000 per patient. And then adjusting for the mortality rate with and without treatment, it looked to me, if you just focus on childhood years, to cost about £3,500 per life year saved. Is that too high or is that too low? Well, there are different thresholds that different countries use for a cost-effectiveness threshold. In the UK, for example, the cost-effectiveness threshold is between £20,000 and £30,000 for quality-adjusted life years. So then there are two challenges. How bad should we rate life with severe disability? This is where the figure came from, that empirical study that I pointed before. It's a utility on average of about 0.6. But we don't necessarily have to stay there. One thing that we can do, if we take the existing cost effectiveness thresholds, is say what would the cost per quality be with different values of quality of life? Or alternatively, if we say, if we use the £20,000 cutoff, how low does our rating of quality of life need to be for treatment to exceed the cost threshold? And here, if Q is less than 0.17, the cost effectiveness for children with severe hydrocephalus is going to exceed that standard cost per quality threshold. We can ask the question a slightly different way and say, if we assume a very low but positive quality of life, let's say that this child who we're thinking about in intensive care doesn't have a life that's not worth living, perhaps I can relieve their pain with analgesics, but and they're going to have a Q of 0.1, what cost per quality threshold would then need to be using for this to be cost ineffective? If we use a cost per quality threshold of £34,000, it looked like the treatment would be too expensive. So do resources provide an argument against surgery? Well, in this specific context, it seems somewhat challenging, both for the reasons that I alluded to earlier, also because surgery is relatively inexpensive per life year saved. And in most instances, unless utility is rated very low, it's unlikely to exceed the existing thresholds in countries like the UK. Other countries that use lower thresholds, treatment may become futile on that ground. So these were some of the practical suggestions that I had for the neurosurgeons when I talked to them about that specific case. Palliative shunting may be appropriate, but one way of managing the resources in this sort of instance is to avoid the more expensive elements and perhaps to specifically discuss with the family the idea that if complications arose, that they wouldn't be actively treated.